There is this type of person who wants to rigorously police what can and can't be said. We've seen a lot of people who are basically bullying, often pretending to be victims. I mean, why are the police listening to these insane men?
Boredom means you have to find things to do. But now there is no boredom.
I think it's like a spiritual crisis. And now we're sort of telling people, well, you must be an individual. And this is the only way you're going to get recognition. So making people think that they have to be an individual, in some cases, is going to push people into kind of really quite extreme modes of behavior. Probably only about 7 to 9% of people are able to deal with ideas that they don't like. People stopped talking about class and economic injustice and started wittering on about identity and race, and this was a very bad move. And now you have these strange alliances between sort of really fervent Muslims who want homosexuals dead and queers for Palestine, and it's like, this isn't going to work.
Weakness to be wroth with weakness, woman's pleasures, woman's pain. Nature gave them blinder motions, bounded in a shallower brain. Woman is the lesser man, and all thy passions matched with mine are as moonlight unto sunlight and as water unto wine. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, today I shall be interviewing my good friend Nina Power, who is a woman. Although she's a very special kind of woman, because she kind of has the brain of a man. So she can do kind of analytic thought, abstract thinking, based stuff, that sort of thing. So it's actually quite a good compromise. Kind of a woman on the inside, a woman on the outside, but a man on the inside. But she's not trans, though. She is a woman. Nina, hello.
Hello, Ed.
How's it been going?
Very well, thank you.
Yes, what's been going on?
Well, I've been at lots of sort of social events. I've been on a pilgrimage to Walsingham.
Yes. In Walsingham?
Yes.
Oh, really?
With the Latin Mass Society.
Good. No, I'm in favour of that. I once had Richard Williamson on here, and he was very much in favour of the old Latin Mass. Mm-hmm. It works better if you understand Latin, but that's
fine. No, it's better if you don't, because the mystery is the point.
That is a good point, you see. That is a good point. That's true. I actually find it quite uplifting when I go to the Finnish Orthodox Church, well, it's the Serbian Orthodox, but it's in Finland, and they chant around, and back when I couldn't understand Finnish, it was kind of better. Mm. And now I can, I'm understanding words like holy and blessed and stuff, and it's not as interesting. So true, we should basically do things in a dead language.
Exactly.
In Old Slavonic,
yep.
Latin, Ancient Greek. Well, actually, to be fair, that's quite similar to modern Greek. We should do that. Now, Nina and I have been having a bit of a chat off screen chats about various interesting things. How women that are based are mainly mad. We'll go on to that later. But one thing we were thinking about is that a lot of people that are, as it were, based, use a nom de guerre. And it will be quite interesting, and it will be quite interesting when one day we can, or you can, not us, obviously, we're brave enough to just be out there under our own names, but when we can drop the nom de guerres and just go for it, and there'll be what Nina called the great re-socialising, which I keep forgetting that term, but I had to write it down, but the great re-socialising, and I think that's a very interesting concept. So what did you mean by that?
Well, I think it's already happening, right? So insofar as you've had all these attempts to atomise everyone and to make them into sort of depressed Netflix-watching subjects who simply sort of order things from their house but don't really have any kind of social interaction, like in the parish or friend groups, and this kind of attempt to police the pub, and, you know, even buying a pint is like £10 and you can't smoke. And it's very obvious from a certain point of view that there's an attack on people getting together and talking face-to-face, right? Whether you're conspiratorial about it or not. And I think there is a concerted effort, right? It's deliberate. So I think people are sick of this. They're also sick of the lockdown, you know, the government telling everyone to be in their houses, which made a lot of these sort of loneliness and depression and addiction things worse. And so, and lots of people have also been cancelled from their annoying, awful friendship groups for having a sense of humour or whatever. So I think there has been this already concerted effort for people to break out of the kind of podcast brain isolation and to meet in person, right? So you have all these organisations, you have para academic institutions, there are lots of these things going on because people want to talk to each other and they want to talk freely. And obviously there's a good reason why people might want to be anonymous or pseudonymous online, particularly if they have a family or a job, and say the things that they nevertheless think. And that's been enormously powerful. In fact, you know, that swayed probably the last American election, for example. And people clearly want to be able to speak.
How did it do that?
Well, I think the clearly J.D. Vance in particular was listening to a lot of the Anon people on X and taking his cues from some of what they were saying around various real things, let's say, true things.
It's interesting, the idea as well of... I find it incomprehensible. I mean, I'm talking to you there, viewers. You're terribly young, most of you. I've got the data, okay? Me and Nina are terribly old. And you know, we're kind of 45 more, okay? You know, it was much freer. I'm telling you, it was much freer in the 90s. And there was no question of, you know, getting into an argument and the police getting involved. It didn't work like that. But now it does work like that. And you can't be sure what you can say to other people.
Because everyone's internalised a kind of surveillance police mindset, right? In the 90s, people were not running around filming each other with their phones or recording conversations, which I know has happened to various people, provoking them to say something at a party and then recording them. And then, you know, we weren't living in this kind of Stasi. And think about Zersetzung, which was a Stasi campaign around honey trapping and a kind of moral disintegration campaign. And a lot of the people working for Zersetzung, most of them, if not all, were volunteers. So, no, there is this kind of strain, this type of person who wants to rigorously police what can and can't be said and then punish people if they've said the wrong thing. And I mean, look how crazy the censorship laws, look at treatment of Graham Linehan. You know, we've entered this weird stage where it counts more what you say than what you do. You know, you think of that old phrase like deeds, not words. And from the standpoint of the British state, it's now words, not deeds.
Sticks and stones.
Right.
Sticks
and stones. Also, we grew up with that, sticks and stones. It's like, yeah, if someone insults you, like, don't worry about it, you know. An offence was kind of part of the humour of that age, you know. And like, if you went to university in the 90s and you met people who were like conservatives or right wing or left wing or whatever, you might have a laugh. You might be like, ah, oh, you're such a Tory boy. But you wouldn't hate them. You wouldn't try to... I don't know, ruin their lives or like stalk their family.
No, you'd see them. This is true. You would. I remember. I don't know if she's watching. And hello, if you are, Rachel. But I lived next door in my first year to a leading member of Young Labour.
Right.
And I wasn't a leading member of Young Conservatives, but I was the secretary, or I had been the secretary of my local Conservative Association. And there was no problem being friends at all.
Of course.
And
not.
She went on to be the deputy mayor of Tower Hamlets. And okay, we lost touch, but there was no, it was just, as far as she was concerned, I was wrong. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, I was a state school boy and a Conservative, and she was a public school girl and into New Labour. But as far as she was concerned, I was wrong and she was right, and me vice versa. But I didn't care and she didn't care.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the stakes weren't, there wasn't this sense in which evil people are about to do mendacious. It was just, this is a person who I like, but I happen to disagree with her on certain things.
No, and you could argue drunkenly with people about all kinds of things without falling out, because there was a sort of default, jolly sort of friendship idea and socialisation. And if you didn't get on with someone, you just didn't have to talk to them. Mm. And no one was recording anything and no one was noting down. And it was sort of funny and, I don't know, much more lighthearted. And also politics hadn't kind of taken over everything. Like, remember how important music was, for example. It mattered more which bands you liked in the 90s than what politics you held. And actually, politics in general was regarded as something a bit nerdy, like if you were too into it. Do you know what I mean? People were more concerned with, like, their social life or what novels they were reading or what bands they were listening to. And I think that was a good thing. It was much healthier, whereas the sort of politicisation of everything has created this sort of horrific polarisation.
I remember talking, I don't know if you remember this, but I remember talking to my parents, probably in the 80s it was. My parents voted Conservative, and I think their friends did. But there were some people, they knew that Anne and Simon vote Labour. I was like, really? Yeah. Mm. And that was the end of it. It was like, that's a bit weird. But that was that. Why would they like that ginger bald man? But that was, you know, that was the end of it. It was, right. it wasn't a big thing. So, how have we got to this point?
I don't know. I mean, there's some interesting work around pathocracy and the takeover of societies by extreme kind of people with personality disorders, and some people who are kind of narcissistic and sadistic, who are able to sort of manipulate others, and bullies, really. Like, we've seen a lot of people who are basically bullying, often pretending to be victims, who have got the ear of the police, for example. We see this in the kind of these insane men who pretend to be women, calling the police and basically getting them to arrest Graham Linehan, for example. I mean, why are the police listening to these insane men, you know, pretending to be women? Like, why would they let themselves be captured? And it's not just individuals. It's like Stonewall and Mermaids and all these horrible groups that have basically run these sorts of opinion mafias that see companies punished if they don't adhere to these like deranged ideas about how people can change sex.
And yeah, yeah. Still now, I mean, there was a chap I was talking to at the conference we were at, mm-hmm. and he said he's gay, and he said that when I see the rainbow flag, I just see the swastika.
Yeah.
And he was saying this a long time ago.
Yeah.
He was saying this in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this idea of he was asked to do a float for Brighton Pride, he said. And he had this idea of of it covered with the rainbow flag, and then people who, like Ku Klux Klan dress, but the rainbow flag, and instead of KKK, it'd be gay.
Yeah, very good.
And brilliant. And that was it. He was the butch sure. lesbian in charge of the committee was like, get out.
I think, one thing would be to sort of work out why people became so humourless.
Mm.
I mean, this is a problem, because humour is like very important for sort of social harmony, really, because it sort of deals with any, I don't know, people getting too fanatical and too serious, and it also kind of keeps things light, and you can make jokes a little bit and become friends by being a little bit cheeky, you know, and that seems to have gone quite a lot, not everywhere.
When I was in Birmingham, after we met there, as I think I told you earlier, I was doing a sort of documentary about Birmingham, and I thought it would be funny, and I knew it would be funny because I'd done it before when I was in Leicester, to walk around Spark Hill and Sparbrook, mm-hmm. which are two of the most Muslim-dominated areas of Birmingham.
Yeah.
And where was that long white thing?
Oh, the jilbab, I think.
Yeah, the jilbab. And just walk around wearing the jilbab. And I felt this was humour, white guy in their area, and it is their area, wearing their clothes. And they loved it. And people would beat their horn, stop the car, lean out the window and say, respect to me. They loved it. And it was only some humourless, white, old bitch in a church that said, oh, you're like taking the piss out of my Muslim friends. I'm like, no, I'm not, right? And they like it. Like, they like it, right? But you are this bitter, twisted old woman who is determined to find fault and a problem and to kind of engage in moral one-upmanship in everything.
Yeah.
You don't like it. And it's people like that, humourless, happy people.
Yeah.
Who have been allowed to be listened to.
Well, I think it's also, I mean, I walked around Spark Hill as well with my camera on my own, and I did not get that friendly reception, I have to say. I got a lot of really hostile stares, and particularly from men in cars. And, you know, I was worried about people confronting me, like, what are you taking photos of this area for? Which is, as you say, like completely Muslim. The only white person I saw was evident junkie trying to beg for money. And that was it.
There's a few Sikhs in the area.
Yeah.
I got free lunch because they give out free food at their gurdwara.
Yeah, there are a few Sikhs, yeah.
But yeah, obviously their attitude was very different.
And it was full of rubbish, can I just say? Like, there was rubbish, bins everywhere. It was very, very untidy. I really do think that people should tidy up, especially by the main mosque, the central mosque. There was rubbish everywhere in that area. And I just thought, like, why can't you tidy up around your holy place of worship? I'm very against litter. I think litter is a really bad sign.
Well, yeah, you say that, but we're talking about the 80s and our child and stuff being better.
Yeah.
And, I mean, when did you last see a white dog shit?
Right, well, in the countryside, I mean, it's a bit different, but... No, but it was tidy. People looked after their village. Like, the village I grew up in was very tidy. People were very, very, like, keen. My parents always tidy the road they live on. They live half a mile away from anyone else. And people think in country lanes that they can dump things and God won't see. So they were constantly, like bin bags of porn. You know, like men, when people still had paper porn, you know, magazines. Presumably their wives had found their porn collection and said, look, you really should throw this out. So they'd drive in their car and out of shame, they would throw their porn collection in bin bags. And my brother would sometimes take them and give them to people at school, good boys at school. But yeah, I mean...
Not to teachers.
No, not to teachers.
No. But anyway, yeah. So, it was much more laid back.
Yeah.
And the general, I suppose you had a generation that had... More to think about. You had people. I mean, we don't even have to go back. And this may sound terribly patronising, and you know we're bloody old and that. But you only have to go back. I remember at school, at infant school, you did your PE mm-hmm. in your underwear.
Yeah.
And that probably now would be considered like a child protection safeguarding issue. But in those days, that was just what you did. And there were some kids, not when I was at school. I mean, but like. People born, let's say, 1970 or a bit earlier than that, that were excused from PE because their parents were so poor that they couldn't afford knickers, underpants, whatever. They couldn't afford them.
Wow.
And that's known. And so, you I don't know if you've seen the film Kez.
Yeah.
And he was an example of that. Mm-hmm. His parents were so poor, they couldn't afford underwear. And so they had more to be concerned about. And there's this idea, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that once you get richer and richer and richer, only at that point do you start to become concerned about things like valid... You assume, oh, of course I'm going to have enough food.
Yeah.
Of course I'm going to have heating. Of course I'm going to... And then it's the concern about validation and identity and all of these decadent kind of things that you really shouldn't be thinking about.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, yeah, probably what are you going to do? You've got your basic needs taken care of. Like, what about your needs to be sadistic to random people you don't know? Like,
yeah,
that's a higher need, presumably.
Well, yeah, presumably if you're basically... Are we living in a world where we're just bored?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I definitely think we had more time to be bored. I think boredom is good. I mean, we had time to be bored. I definitely remember being bored in the 80s and 90s. I mean, I listened to the radio quite obsessively and read novels. But there are definitely periods of like boredom. But I think in retrospect, that was great because they're sort of character forming and you can reflect on what you've read. And books were much more random. Like someone would lend you a book and then this would become your personality for like a while because it was the only book you had sort of... You know, access.
There was a whole children's TV program dedicated to conquering boredom called
That's
Why
right.
Don't
well,
You?
Yes,
which I... was not Why Don't You? If you're in a car journey, then get a bit of paper and put a pen on it, and it'll go up and down.
And like... one of the lyrics for the song is really amazing because it was on TV, but it said things like, "Why don't you do something less boring? Switch off your TV set and do something less boring instead." So it was a kind of TV show that was literally telling you to turn it off, which I really admire.
Slightly ironic, but
cool.
Also I could barely understand it because it was in Northern Irish and I wasn't from there. But true. It was boredom, and the boredom means you have to find things to do. But now there is no boredom. Mm-hmm. You can't be bored really because there is constant stimulation from this bad boy. And so you could always find something that they have never...
I think it's like a spiritual crisis. I think when people were Christian or post-Christian enough that they understood that they, like, everyone was broken and, you know, you needed community and you could be a slightly better person. And now we're sort of telling people, well, you must be an individual. You must have an identity. And this is the only way you're going to get recognition. So it's a kind of recognition crisis, partly. And I think it's a symptom of the technology, but it's also a spiritual crisis, which is what I think a lot of so-called personality disorders are as well.
What? How's that?
Well, insofar as, like, I think if you understand that there is a kind of let's just stick to Britain, but like a kind of spiritual crisis insofar as people's need for community and a sense of themselves as a kind of a moral being whose life has meaning and all of those sorts of things, which religion gives you, absolutely. Then you start to get these kind of like very twisted and very medical and very therapeutic. We also live in a highly medicalized and highly therapeutized society in which we don't explain things through spiritual descriptions, but rather through there must be some chemical problem or there must be some developmental problem or some problem that you need to talk to somebody about, right? We've replaced like the confession with the therapist. And then within that framework, the only diagnosis you can give to people are going to be therapeutic, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to end up telling people, oh, well, you're a bit like this, therefore you're probably borderline or whatever it is, you know. And it's usually like saying to somebody, you're a bit too much for the people around you, right? And we're going to give you a diagnosis, not talk about your general social situation or your family situation. I mean, this is why figures like R.D. Lang in the anti-psychiatry movement, for all of their flaws, were trying to do this. They were trying to say, look, this is not about an individual. In a way, an individual doesn't really exist. Like, we're all a kind of relational, primarily, right? We are who we are in relation to other people, to our spouses and children, and the, you know, our friends and everything else. So making people think that they have to be an individual in some cases is going to push people into kind of really quite extreme modes of behavior and so on. I mean, you're probably a Darwinian or something, aren't you, ultimately?
I don't know.
But I mean, you're very interested, I think, in kind of biological explanations for things.
I'm thinking, from what you're saying, that let's call me an Aristotelian.
Okay.
I want to, the world is a series of sort of jumbling chaos, and I want to make sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can make sense of it, if I can say, oh, Nina's done some quirky thing, what's that about? Oh, does she have aspects of these traits? Mm-hmm. Maybe she does. Then I'm making my world make sense more. I'm dividing the world into cautiously essentialist categories,
sure.
Via which cautious, though correct more times than not, predictions can be made, and I think that's really the essence of science. And so, yeah, on the one hand, you can say all people are individuals and all this, and that's true, I suppose. But on the other hand, then you can carefully put people into kind of almost platonic types, not like that, not as black and white as that, but you can conceive of a spectrum of a particular trait and a suite of traits, and some people will be sufficiently high in them that they let you predict, okay, this is what they'll do in these circumstances. And in those cases where it's clinical,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to subclinical, which is complicated, then they probably will react in that way. And so then you are negotiating your world more successfully.
Sure. I mean, obviously pattern recognition, which is usually verboten in most situations and in a liberal worldview, is very important, and it does tell you a lot of things, and everybody has tendencies, so you could say this person's tendency for this and that. But I think, you know, for example, with personality disorders, I think there's a way out of them. You know, I think it's one thing to notice and to say you have these tendencies, and another to think that that worldview is also the place where you're going to find the solution or the cure or to improve things or not. It may well lie outside of the medical worldview, what the solution is, if you see what I mean.
Mm.
So, you know, I think, as I say, I think there's a spiritual crisis, and a lot of people can actually improve their behaviour and get out of certain patterns and tendencies through adopting better habits.
When I can't find enough base knowledge to feed the inner workings of my mind, and I go onto Audible, and all I can find is warmed-up diarrhea by people like Adam Rutherford and Angela Saini, I sometimes don't know what to do. But that's why I use Legion.com. Legion.com gets the most based books, summarises them into key salient points and reads them to you in 25 enthralling minutes, whether it's my own books or whether it's Who We Are and How We Got Here by David Reich, a fascinating book which allows us to understand in much more depth the evolution of man using archaeogenetics, taking old skeletons, analysing the different alleles and telling you exactly how we evolved. Whatever based book it is, Legiont.com is the one for me.
For example, you've talked to me a bit about this, and I ran this past you, and you said it was okay to ask you about these things.
Sure.
If you don't mind, can you tell me a bit about your own experience of,
sure.
of getting out of here?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess quite a long time ago now, I definitely would say in retrospect that I was histrionic. I had tendencies towards being
Would you mind awfully expanding on
what? Yeah, so I guess histrionic personality disorder is the less cool one. Well, no, they're all very uncool, but I guess people are more familiar with like narcissistic personality disorder or borderline personality disorder, which often a lot of women get diagnosed with in particular. I mean, so I guess they're cluster B, we would say. Well, you know more about this than me, but I suppose histrionic personality disorder would be someone who's always performing, always seeking attention. It's a bit like an actor, right? Mm. Someone who's always sort of playing a role and is perhaps very, develops very intense relationships with people very quickly. You know, is looking for a kind of intense form of affirmation or sort of excitement and that kind of thing. And I think, you know, a bit like borderline, it's a very sort of unstable way to be in the world. You know,
Well, I suppose it's an adaptation to what you see as an unstable world.
Yeah.
So in an unstable world, then you will get what you want. I don't know. People looking after you or something, mm-hmm. By being, as you say, histrionic.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of stereotypical example from which I think the whole notion of it developed was the kind of woman that would have ostentatious fainting fits,
mm-hmm.
things like that, and then retire to their bed for months at a time. And they'd get what they basically wanted, which was to be looked after.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a kind of manipulative form of... So why did you adopt this form?
Well, it wasn't sort of deliberate. I think partly I was also like an increasingly heavy drinker, and this is a sort of something that was exacerbated, right, through alcohol use, which is disinhibiting, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think generally negative for people who have a tendency towards one personality disorder or another. So I'd just become very, very like socially domineering, for example, like just become very, very like attention seeking, very flirtatious, all of these kinds of things, right? Not really consciously, I would say. And I think the emotional range, when you're in a very sort of emotionally kind of labile state, your emotions are very, very high and very, very low, and you kind of oscillate wildly in this dramatic way between them. And it's very painful, right? And you do feel these feelings very intensely. And it's a really, really unpleasant way to be, actually, because you do feel them as though they're real. You know, it's not an act in that sense. Internally, your feelings are like painfully real, like whether it's guilt or... I don't know. Yeah, the need to be intensely admired or something like that. But what I'm saying is it's positive, because I think a lot of people get these diagnoses, particularly women, and you can get out of them. I mean, I think they decline anyway as you age.
So when did it start, this kind of thing?
I think I was probably like that as a teenager, you know. Like, I always used to hang around with men, with boys, and just be like very, very sort of... like attention seeking, basically. No, I was like one of those girls who would like punch boys, you know, that kind of girl. I was quite tomboyish, and then I was like, do you know, in that sort of playful way, like trying to provoke.
Yeah, I guess vaguely. But I don't associate it with... I mean, I was at a boys' school.
Yeah.
So we didn't have many girls. But but then in the sixth form, that was mixed.
Yeah.
And I think my mum kind of warned me, essentially. Look, you're going to... She's a teacher. that you're going to meet girls and probably be a bit more careful about what you say because they're basically mental. and she told me that she had taught at both boys and girls schools and at mixed schools. And what she hated the most was teaching at girls' schools.
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, not just what you're talking about, but also a lot of this bitchiness and snideness and manipulative kind of behaviour.
Yeah, I mean, women don't have a choice. I mean, they can't engage in physical violence.
But they can't each other.
They can, but, I mean, it's not really the done thing. So women have famously...
When I was 16, yeah. I was at a birthday party and these two girls started fighting. And
sure.
We gathered around and we found it very... yeah.
Well, okay, let's put it this way. It's not the usual sort of strategy to sort of punch someone in the face if you're
no, scratch and bite. True. So this started as a teenager, and yeah. So then you go to university in, was it Warwick?
Mm-hmm.
And did it get worse?
Yeah, in different ways. I mean, I think, you know, I was also very intellectual, so I worked really hard. I wasn't just, oh, I want attention, I'm not going to do any work. And I think a lot of the problem today is, like, people think, because of this identitarian thing, they think, well, my identity alone is enough. This should make me interesting enough, you know, because I've got this and that neurological thing, or I'm going to define as this and that, and that's my whole character, you know. So to be fair to me, I did actually work extremely hard and, you know, to improve my mind and to become more interesting. And I was very interested in philosophy. I mean, I'd gone to a mixed school. I went to a comprehensive school. And I mean, I actually have to say, I think mixed schools are a really bad idea for both boys and girls. I think a lot of time is wasted because you inevitably at puberty get that kind of, you know, interest in each other. And it's sort of pointless. And a lot of time is spent in this kind of, you know, actually ultimately meaningless time wasting sort of thing between teenage boys and teenage girls, you know, because they don't really know how to sort of cope with feelings and whatever, the hormonal shift. And I think it actually would be better for both.
For most of our history, girls and boys are separated at school.
Yeah.
And I'm aware of research, I think I did a video on it once, which finds again and again and again, that both girls and boys, particularly boys, do better at single-sex schools.
Yeah, that would make sense. I mean, you're removing, like, the major source of distraction.
The only problem is that then you get... you kind of feel you don't know how to deal with girls.
Sure, but that's where, like, the great re-socialising would come in. Because, I mean, think about all of the social forms and the kind of rituals that we used to have that would introduce men and young men and women to each other, right, that have kind of been eroded in this sort of liberal melange. You know, it doesn't have to be, like, the formal ball or the, you know, the debutante's ball, but even think about, I don't know, going to discos and that kind of thing, where there were these sort of designated places and times really for young people to meet that were in a sense chaperoned, however loosely. I mean, that all disappeared, that all eroded, and it just became a sort of free-for-all. But now I think we have a lot of young people who don't really know how to meet each other and are struggling to communicate with the opposite sex, and the apps have not helped, and they're not trying to, because they want to keep you on the app.
Yeah, when we moved from year 11 to sixth form, the sixth form was mixed with the Catholic girls' school down the road. And the school was very clever. It organised a sort of an inset day or a couple of days, an orientation, couple of days. And the first thing the guy that was running it said was, OK, get up and go and sit next to someone that you don't know. And, of course, this was a way of forcing the boys and the girls to mix, because prior to that, they'd be sitting on the other side of the sixth form common room, not talking. And I was fortunate in that my mother, I think, had preempted this problem and was most insistent that I would go to a drama club, essentially, once a week throughout my time at school, where, of course, there were girls. In fact, it was overwhelmingly girls.
Mm-hmm.
It was like 27 girls and 3 boys. So I was no problem talking to girls.
Yeah.
But my friend, Kieran, he refused to move out of his seat. He was that nervous of girls, having had nothing to do with them since he was 11, and by now he's 16. He refused to move. It was embarrassing.
Mm.
He's married now, and fine. But that is one of the problems with it.
Well, I think also people used to have bigger families, so you would have brothers and sisters.
Oh,
and
yeah,
cousins,
yeah, he only had brothers.
Right, so, you know, normally there'd also be things outside school where you'd be involved with other people.
Sunday school.
Yeah, or the church or whatever. And I think that's sort of, you know, as people have had one child or whatever, or two children, that doesn't happen so much.
No. So how did you... So you said that you had this... You self-diagnosed as this history...
I didn't walk around saying it. It's something I think about in retrospect.
Yeah, exactly. I'm saying you've realised in retrospect that you had this.
Yeah.
And you have Irish ancestry, so you're a hereditary drunk. No, Nina was telling me earlier that alcohol came later to Ireland.
It was one theory, yeah.
Yeah, one theory. So, as I say, hereditary drunk, histrionic disorder. And so, how...
Yep.
How did you...
How could I possibly rescue myself from such a non-propitious set of circumstances?
How did you... Yeah, pretty much. No, that's the one. That's the fella.
Well, I must say, I had a terrific nervous breakdown in my 30s, like of a colossal scale, because my life was completely untenable. I was also on the left. I used to be on the left.
Did you?
Well, before it went completely insane, but maybe it was always insane. I just didn't notice. But, you know, I was very involved in the student movement, right, around trying to keep the fees lower. If you recall, in 2010, they tripled the tuition fees. I was very committed to free education, not least because my experience at school, I'd been around a lot of intelligent people who hadn't gone to university for reasons of class, essentially. And then when I went to university, I met all these people who'd apparently done brilliantly at A-level and whatnot, but they were really obviously very stupid and they weren't working very hard. So I had this kind of weird, I don't know, defense of, I suppose, poorer people who are intelligent. And I didn't want those people to be put off going to university. So I was very pro free education and I still am in some ways. I do think, and we discussed this last time, I think, I think probably only about 7 to 9% of people are able to deal with ideas that they don't like at a higher level, right? Because a lot of people are put off by reality, if you saw what I mean.
Yes.
So they don't like to confront it. They can't actually cognitively cope with difficult ideas. And the world is difficult.
My understanding, and this may be an urban myth, but the Ecole Normale Supérieure and the entrance exam, you are given a particular, you know, question or whatever, which has a sort of, is it true or not, yes or no. And you have to write an essay, two essays, one arguing the first case and the other arguing the second case.
Yeah, that sounds right. I mean, that kind of thing. So people who are able to, not just in a legal way, right, in a deep philosophical way, take up different positions. Actually, a surprisingly few number of people can do that. So I think what we've had in the woke madrasa expansion of universities is just, they've just become ideology factories, right, for the middle class, which then generates this sort of feeling of superiority. And you can see how much the middle class hates the working class in the response to the rape gangs. You know, for decades we were told, oh, these were just white trash. You know, this Labour MP just got...
Labour councillor,
just lost his job for saying this recently. You know, this class segregation, this idea that people from poorer working class backgrounds are just dispensable according to the god of multiculturalism, and it's fine.
They've betrayed. The left are, well, not all of the left, but most of the left are people that are power-hungry individualists.
Yeah.
And they find, what can we do? We make a coalition with people that are... We empathise with people that are quite distant from us, and via this we make a coalition and we get power. And that coalition was with the white working class, but you can romanticise, which they romanticised.
Yeah,
people
sure.
Like Tony Benn romanticised these people. They didn't know anything about the white working class. And then you can romanticise so much more easily these brown people from spicy exotic countries. And then the working class then suddenly are dispensable.
Yeah.
And once they're dispensable and you don't romanticise them, then they don't actually agree with you either. They're they're opposing you. Well, then they're scum.
Absolutely.
And it's really interesting how quickly I noticed them use snobbish language as well. They'll say that, oh, classy. I remember some tweet I think it was Jess something or other, a classy way to do it, racists, like that, classy. Mm. So they're attacking you for being lower class while in theory defending.
Yeah, I think that switch absolutely happened. And yeah, people stopped talking about class and economic injustice and started wittering on about identity and race and queerness or whatever. And this was a very bad move. And now you have these strange alliances, like you say, between sort of really fervent Muslims who want homosexuals dead and queers for Palestine. And it's like, this isn't going to work.
No, well, I wonder to what extent their coalitions are inherently unstable.
Yeah, always. Totally.
Always.
Well, maybe. Well, perhaps. But I do, you know, there were some decent people. There still are some decent people, like the Blue Labour Project, for example, based a lot in, you know, Catholic social thought and, you know, the parish and that kind of thing. You know, there were a lot of sort of socialist philanthropic movements that were based in local communities. And that is part of the history of the left as well. But it's just that all is just completely ignored now. And if you talk about class, then you're somehow like you must be a racist or something because you're not focusing
on race.
On race.
I was in a pub in Oulu and I made this point that immigration is bad, and it is, for the Finnish working class.
Yeah, absolutely. And this, that was a left-wing position.
Right,
yeah.
And this woman, who was a bit drunk, admittedly, and we were speaking in a combination of English and Finnish, and she's like, no, it is we should talk about everybody, not just the Finnish. And I was like, well, no, hang on. And then a friend of mine intervened and said, well, look, in Britain, it's undermined the wage. Mm-hmm. Oh, you are fucking British. You are so fucking British. You do not understand. And then they got up, all of these four people, and just walked to the next table. And then I was barred from the pub. And for like causing discord. But this is, they cannot. Whereas I think back, God Almighty, I think back to when I was 17 years old and I was a teller, you know, so you sit there outside the polling station and you get people to give you a polling card. So then you know if your supporters have voted. And then if they haven't, then you can ring them up and get them to go out and vote, right? A teller. So I'd sit there. Me, I was 17 year old. A chap who was the Labour chap, old guy with a beard, and then the Lib Dem, I forget, some middle-class woman. And we sat there for hours merrily chatting, despite being on different sides. And then I did that again in the 2015 election. So 98, 2015. And then it was very different. And then it was just me, the Conservative, and the Labour person. And she didn't really want to talk to me. I tried making conversation with her, and we'd have a kind of conversation, but there was tension. She didn't like it at all. She didn't like it, particularly not when I started talking about intelligence differences. We said, well, you know, the research indicating that intelligence has been debunked.
Of course.
I was like, ah, let's talk about that. And then it didn't work. Things had changed. Possibly Labour had got, the left had got stupider.
Maybe.
But how did you move beyond then this, you had a nervous breakdown, yeah. You say. So what's, if you don't mind saying so, people use that term. It's a bit like jet lag it's this term that everyone uses, but I'm like, what does it actually mean?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I think in my case, it was like absolutely unable to continue with any of the things that I was supposed to be doing. And I had to leave my job. I had to stop drinking. I had to get fit. I had to basically not do anything for about a year. I mean, I had insomnia for 17 weeks at one point. I started hallucinating. I was kind of mad, really quite mad. It was interesting, actually, to be that mad.
Was
to have like a psychotic break.
How was it interesting?
Well, because it sort of gave me an insight into, well, madness in the first place. And because I knew something was wrong. And because I hadn't been mad when I was younger, I think it was interesting. So I went to see a psychiatrist. I was referred to a psychiatrist. And they said, well, this isn't a permanent state. Because normally if you've got a severe mental illness, it's diagnosed much younger, right? So this is a reaction to your current circumstances, where I was trying to do two jobs, run a political campaign, and drinking way too much, you know, I just lost the plot basically completely. And I'd lost my sense of judgment. But the most interesting thing was I had this experience of language where I could hear the meaning, like the multiple meanings, because, you know, polysemy, like we've got lots of words that mean multiple things, and we discern their meaning from context. Mm. So, but when people were speaking, I kind of felt everything they said, and I felt all the meanings of different words all at once. It was like the sort of language crystal, and my head was like exploding.
Language synesthesia or something.
It was completely mad. It was like I was totally sort of moved, extremely emotional reaction to everything everyone was saying all the time. And it felt like this kind of absolute chaos. Certain words took on more extreme meaning. So indeed, words that began with EX were like really important words. And it was clearly mad. I knew I was mad. And I was sort of hallucinating. I saw aliens on the bus. I wrote this in a chat that then got leaked, and people then started like taking the piss out of me. You know, she's crazy. Everything she says must be mad. This is another nice strategy of the current left, in order to diminish you. You know, if you ever admit
you
ever
sympathize,
had a problem.
They sympathize heavily with those that are mentally ill and say it's part of their illness, shouldn't be cured, unless they disagree with them.
Absolutely.
In which case, their mental illness is a sign that they are a bad person.
Absolutely. That's exactly how it works.
Yes. Yep. That sounds quite extreme.
Yeah. I mean, it was very interesting. It took and then for a long time I felt really burnt out. Like I was just completely, I felt like a match, like a spent match for months. And then I got better. I didn't drink for a long 2.5 years, and I don't drink now. I haven't drank for a long time. And I got fit. You know, I was in a terrible physical state. And I embraced nature, actually. I became very pagan for a while. Spent all my time outside. I know why mad people like being outside. A lot of homeless people like being outside. And I sort of
like
know
why.
Like
in that commercial, I want to be a tree.
Sort of.
You won't remember that if you're young.
There is something, if you're in a very bad mental state, about being outside, which, because being inside feels like a prison, actually.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like friendly or kind. It feels like you're being trapped. So this is why lots of mad people like being outside.
And you liked being outside.
I did. I was outside like for as much time as I possibly could be every day.
And does this interfere with your ability to be a university lecturer?
Well, yeah, so I left my job. And also people started attacking me. So because I, in 2018, but before that, they could tell people I'd sort of been allies with on the university stuff. I hadn't really realized that in 2013, 2014, 15, the identity stuff was really picking up, and partly through Tumblr and the internet and weird stuff, people suddenly started being obsessed with the trans thing, for example. And I just thought, originally I thought, oh gosh, well, these people seem upset. They must be upset about something. Oh, maybe there is something here. I thought, well, I don't really understand it. And presumably it's a very small number of people. So I was just like, okay, whatever, you know, go along with it. But then I sort of thought about it, as you do, and you go, this makes no sense and is actually really, really awful. And they're telling children they can change sex when they can't. And this is actually a horrific turn of events. So I would, you know, for a while I was sort of getting drunk and at parties and trying to engage people in conversation. I was trying to say, can we talk about this? Like, I don't understand what's going on. Like, can you explain it to me? And people were like, no. Getting very angry with me, and then I would get upset. So I was kind of already like socially blacklisted and slightly marked because I'd said things like, that's not a woman, that's a man, at a party.
Yeah, I try to engage. So when I was an undergraduate, in my second year, I lived briefly with three practicing witches. Two of whom were a lesbian couple called Becca and Holly. And Becca was a PhD student, and Holly was a philosophy undergrad, and she was the femme. And they were quite... I didn't really want to live there. Basically, I'd been in a kind of a semi-relationship with this girl and ended up living with her in the second year, but by then it had sort of broken down and it was disastrous. And I wish I'd taken up my Christian fundamentalist friends as offered to live with them, who I eventually then did live with for the rest of the year. Good old Christian fundamentalists. You can always trust them, within reason. And just don't swear too much. And so I lived with them until these Christians said, look, for God's sake, all is forgiven. Come and live in our spare room. Mm-hmm. It was like 2 weeks, and I got on quite well with this couple, not with the girl who was my friend who had said come and live with me. Like she was depressed and lived in the attic, like was habit, Bertha Rochester, yeah. Who was Jamaican, I believe.
Yeah.
But so with them, and it was fine. And then in the third year, the girl, Holly, the femme, became kind of androgynous and shaved her hair off and stuff. And it was a shame, really, because she was quite pretty. And then, for a pretty private school girl. And then the next thing I came across her was when we all got back in touch, with the great getting re-back in touching of Facebook. So sort of 07, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And someone said, oh, I won't use the surname of this person, but someone said, oh, Ed, you know, you have a similar view on this to Jack. Surname. And I was like, who the hell is that? And then I put it and I realised what this person had done. Which was, you know, trans. And she looked ridiculous. I mean, she's about 5'1" anyway. And she'd all bulked up and, God, it was awful. Anyway, I got back in touch with her. And she was talking about being transsexual. And I was so naive about this. I thought that you're transsexual if you've completely changed your body. Mm-hmm. To look, yeah. To resemble the opposite sex. And she said, and she implied something along the lines of, I forget the details, but that she had a vagina. I forget the details. Are you ready for the future of the West?